Hi, I'm Norm Shealy. NormShealy.com. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Richie Shoemaker, and we're going to talk about his book, Mold Warriors, and his battle treating mold in his patient base and with the legal system. How are you, Dr. Shoemaker?
Well, good evening. I'm feeling quite well. I hope you are, too.
Thanks so much for being on with me tonight on an interesting topic, but it's almost frightening to read about it. Scary.
You know, Mold Warriors is 5 years old now, and the new book coming out, Surviving Mold, hopefully will have a lot more messages of hope and promise because we've come a long way in 5 years.
Well, we'll let you tell us about that before we finish up tonight. I'd like to know. So before we get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and how you came to do what you do and where people can find you?
Well, I am just about 60 years old now. I work in a small town in the eastern shore of Maryland. The town's name is Pocomoke, which is an Indian word for broken ground, which may be named for the cypress trees that we have. And it's about as far north as the cypress trees will breed, and about as far south as a lot of plants from the northern tiers come. But most people say, why in the world would anyone live here? It is a beautiful area, but it's underpopulated, but it has everything that I wanted to do when I finished medical school at Duke University in 1977 and did my residency in family practice. I wanted a rural primary care experience, and National Health Service Corps had helped me in medical school. So in payback for that support, I came here, which has, in a way, just been exactly what I wanted to do. And I was very happy to be what I thought was a well-trained physician in an outpatient setting for years, doing primary care and working to coordinate healthcare systems in this kind of pristine environment until in 1997 things changed dramatically. There was an outbreak of an illness that affected first fish in the Pocomoke River, as well as what turned out to be 27 other estuaries of the Chesapeake Bay, but it made people sick too. The illness was one that I had never seen before, and because it was happening right on my back doorstep, people kind of looked to me to try to help figure out what was wrong. The illness was called Fisteria, and people who may have remembered back then that North Carolina had problems with fish kills and maybe some human health problems, but it wasn't until 97 that we had clear delineation of an illness that was caused by a biologically produced neurotoxin that it was confirmed to be a new illness. It was kind of scary because this organism was felt to be related to nutrient enrichment in our watersheds, and goodness, nutrients are a problem all over the country. So question was, you know, if we're facing this potential environmental disaster that's making people so sick, what can you do about it? Well, the answer is nobody knew anything. It wasn't in the textbooks. And this is a multi-system, multi-symptom illness, cognitive problems, respiratory problems, gastrointestinal problems, musculoskeletal problems, you name it. This was wild. It was not anything that I had ever seen. And yet, the gastrointestinal problem was kind of a tip-off because people got this funny kind of diarrhea. We call it secretory diarrhea because people are going all the time, whether they eat or not. And there's an old-fashioned drug we use to lower cholesterol called cholestyramine, and I'll call that CSM probably if I lapse into jargon here. But cholestyramine has long been used to stop secretory diarrhea. So when nothing else worked, I gave these poor suffering folks cholestyramine or CSM, and don't you know it stopped their diarrhea? Well, that was great, but it also fixed their memory. It stopped their cough, stopped their headache, gave them a feeling of life, and their fatigue went away as well. Well, how could that be? That was actually, cholestyramine was binding a toxin that circulated through the body, went into the gut. When it got into the gut, we could bind it with cholestyramine and get rid of it. Otherwise, it was reabsorbed. As it turns out, fistaria was not the only illness that was associated with this multi-system aspects of biotoxins. Blue-green algae problems in Florida were certainly rampant back in 97, 98, and they still are, as well as elsewhere, especially in Georgia. But now we have, in 98, the first people made ill by exposure to water-damaged buildings, so-called sick building syndrome, and we know it's more than a sick building. It's an inflammatory illness now. But post-Lyme syndrome was on the list, and golly, there's any number of different things. So I kind of got started by being in the right place at the right time, or the wrong place if you happen to be on the other side of litigation. But needless to say, it has been my passion and my interest, and now having treated nearly 8,000 people in 12 years, it certainly is my career to fix these illnesses.
Have we always had this sick building syndrome, or is it something new due to materials, or why do we suddenly have it?
That's a good question. We know, back from the Old Testament, the Bible, that people were told to stay away from dwellings that had mold growing in them. At the same time, it is quite strikingly different with the change in building techniques in about the 70s. People talked about, tightening buildings up and not having windows that open or doors that let in a lot of air. But there may have been something else going on, and not just a difference in building techniques. In about 1970 is the first time that paint manufacturers first started adding particular kind of fungus killers or fungicides that are incredibly powerful agents to cause mutation in fungi for those fungi that aren't killed. So at about the same time we changed our building techniques, which reduced indoor air ventilation from outside air, we also brought in organisms that were brand new, that were toxin formers. So it's a combination of things that we saw in industrialized nations. The fungicide, of course, was sold around the world. You don't find this problem in underdeveloped countries. You find it where people have been worried about fungus growth on crops, what have you, so that whether it's tea and coffee in Ceylon or bananas in Costa Rica or strawberries in Florida or artichokes in California, not to mention, what wheat crops in Scotland, it's a worldwide problem. So that wherever the fungicide was, we found these new toxin-forming fungi growing and make people sick.
Interesting. I'm just curious, a thought occurred to me. Is Heliobacter one of those things?
I'm sorry, I could barely hear you. Can you speak up?
Is Heliobacter pylori one of those, connected to those things, or is that?
I think it's a fascinating question. Dr. Mary Marshall, of course, got the Nobel Prize in 2005 for his work with a bacterium, and a lot of people have speculated that the azole derivatives, the benzimidazoles of the stomach acid pills we take all the time, Prilosec is just one, or Prevacid, and there's a whole slew of them, are exactly related to the substituted benzimidazoles that we saw in these fungus killers. It's a great question. I do worry about it, but there's no confirmation yet that I've seen that Helicobacter is related to use of fungicides.
Okay, I was just curious for some reason.
Well, it's a great question. It bothers me a lot that now we have an antidepressant adjunct medicine called Abilify, which is another substituted benzimidazole. These drugs are used everywhere. It's not just fungus killers and stomach acid medicines. They are throughout medicine. And what in the world are we doing to our unwitting patients, giving them drugs that work for one thing but silently create mutations on another?
Oh, don't even get me started on pharmaceutical companies. it's a good thing and a bad thing, I think. But anyway, I'll go off on that because it's one of my passions. So let me get started asking you for my list of questions. What is amplified mold growth?
when we look at ecology, we're looking at groupings of organisms within a given environmental situation. And so if we think about a pile of compost or wet leaves outdoors, we know that fungi will be there. They're going to be digesting these complex materials in leaves and compost and breaking those down. I mean, fungi are probably the 30% of the world's biomass altogether. It's everywhere. These organisms digest big things and release little things that other organisms can use for food. So when we say there is a compost pit with fungus growing in, that's going to make you sick. Actually, that's not the case, because in competition for the little things that fungi must actually take out of the outside world after they've digested them with their enzymes and bring back in, other organisms like bacteria and actinomycetes and things want to compete and take those same foodstuffs. So as it turns out, the ecosystem that we see with fungi in the outside world is not the same as the ecosystem in the inside world. Here in the inside world, or indoors, where there's water damage and plenty of food for fungi, they don't have the competition. And what that means is that now the extra energy that normally would be siphoned off by other organisms is now available for the fungi to make secondary metabolic products.
Oh.
And VOCs and toxins and mannans and hebolysins and all the things that make people sick are found indoors but not outdoors, even if the same fungus is present.
That makes so much sense. I've never thought about it that way. Makes so much sense. Okay. I notice in your book, this mold and the biotoxins has a tremendous list of things that it can do to your body. And the main goal that I want to do here is make people aware, because I don't think people know, on the general person walking around, what symptoms they may be having and what might be causing it. So I kind of want to go over, spend some time on that. I thought that your pathways was very interesting, but it was a little bit over my head. So when we get through, if you want to talk about that, that would be great. But I don't always understand how it works.
A lot of the words that I use, I think, probably are jargon terms. And the first time people look at the biotoxin pathway and they see melanocyte-stimulating hormone and vasoactive intestinal polypeptide, I mean, it sounds like a jaw-breaking collection of terms that doesn't mean anything. But hopefully we'll have a chance to make some of these ideas that live in my mind come alive to you as well. What we're really talking about are the jargon terms of inflammation. And when we say inflammation, it's more than just your knee being red and swollen after it gets hit with a hockey puck in the Olympics. It's the body's response to attack by foreign particles. Now, these particles, we call them antigens, but when they get into the human body, there is a series of defense mechanisms that announce to the body, we are being attacked. And these defense mechanisms, which I call the host response, are a way of signaling that we must mount our defenses and announce to the entire body to respond to the call, because here is warfare in our skin or our lungs or GI tract or in our bloodstream. And this innate immune response, this systemic response, is the inflammation that comes from exposure to all the different kinds of things found in water-damaged buildings, not just mold and not just toxins, bacteria, actinomycetes I've mentioned earlier, but there's a whole host of things that cause inflammation that are not living creatures. They're made by living creatures and enzymes and proteins, what have you. But the symptoms that people get are symptoms from every single organ system in the body, because the inflammatory compounds circulate through blood and they go everywhere. You'll have brain problems and cognitive issues. You'll have fatigue. You'll have musculoskeletal problems we can go back to Fisteria as the initial illness here, respiratory effects and gastrointestinal effects, rheumatologic effects, ocular problems, neurologic problems. It all has to do with what inflammation does to our body.
So when you talk about inflammation, could you talk about what a cytokine storm is?
You know,
and why that happened?
Sure. Cytokines are little proteins, and it's another jargon term, C-Y-T-O, a cell, and then K-I-N-E, meaning motion. But these compounds were first really identified in 1985 with tumor necrosis factor alpha being the first one, and now we take it for granted that stopping cytokines with drugs is critical for rheumatoid arthritis and for psoriasis. We have wonderful medicines that block TNF, but TNF, or tumor necrosis factor alpha, was just the first of these pro-inflammatory compounds to be identified. And it was fascinating that here we are new with these compounds in 1985, and by 1995, there were 10,000 papers on TNF. And as you might expect, there was equal numbers of thousands of papers looking at other kinds of compounds. So when we say cytokine storm, what we're looking at is this surge of chemical release following antigen detection by innate immune compounds or receptors that say we are being attacked. And so what's the body do? It sends out this storm. You know, it might be a good example if we think about the flu shots you heard about,
mm-hmm.
the H1N1 flu. The two antigens, or H1 and N1, are each one that can be detected and processed. But as soon as there is a processing, there is now a body's response. And some people are very unhappy with this body's response because they get muscle ache and tired, and they get fever, and they feel exhausted, and they go to bed. They might be confused. They might have all kinds of respiratory problems and cough. We say, I'm not going to get that flu shot again. I had a reaction to it. Well, what you actually had was a cytokine response to a detected antigen. And depending on how potent the antigen is or how well we can clear it, it will then tell us as whether the storm will be just a passing squall or whether it's a three-day nor'easter that pounds the eastern shore of Maryland, figuratively, in your body as well.
Okay, could you talk a little about MSH and blood-brain barrier, how this thing crosses blood-brain barriers and SSRIs and serotonin? I want to talk a little bit about a question that I have about the gut and serotonin and depression and related to this in a minute, but I'd like for you to talk about mostly MSH, if you would.
Well, melanocyte-stimulating hormone is primarily made up in the brain in the regulatory center called the hypothalamus. It is one of the most interesting compounds in the body, as far as I'm concerned, because it's what we call a regulatory protein or neuropeptide. It controls hormone production in the pituitary. It controls inflammation and cytokines peripherally. It controls a whole host of neurologic events, especially with depression and appetite, what have you. MSH is necessary to control inflammation so that when you have this flu shot that we're talking about and a cytokine storm, MSH levels rise to combat the inflammation. Now, if we got one flu shot after another, and here we come to our mold patients or our sick to building patients, if your body couldn't clear the antigen because of the immunological problem, there will be ongoing inflammation that attacked, and wiped out MSH. And when you lose MSH, you lose control of inflammation wherever MSH should be. And that's the skin and the lung and the gut, especially in the gut and leaky gut we might get a chance to talk about.
Yeah, I want to talk about that next.
And brain and bloodstream. So one of the hallmarks in 98% of patients who have fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue and these illnesses that nobody has a diagnostic test for are going to be low in MSH, almost guaranteed. And specifically, when you start asking the question, how can I put a blood test result on a piece of paper to confirm presence of these illnesses, it is so easy once you go to innate immune responses. You're right. You start with MSH, but then you look for these inflammatory cytokines. You look for genetic control. You look for things that are predictably going to go wild when inflammation is out of control. Now, you mentioned serotonin and blood-brain barrier. MSH goes right through the blood-brain barrier because it's inside the blood. It's actually made as well in the hypothalamus. So it exerts effect not just being circulated, but also because it's made in the brain. And it is major in its regulatory effects, not just in immunologically sanctuaries like the aqueous humor of the eye, but also through every part of the body where blood goes.
Now, this may or not be something in your area of expertise, but is there a way to support MSH levels naturally with supplements or food? Or?
Well, your question is one I've been asking for 12 years. I think I've chased about probably more things than Edison chased to try to find a light bulb filament that works. So far, the answer is no. The way to support MSH is to stop the inflammatory process, because there can be healing of the manufacturing mechanism for MSH if the illness is caught in time. But in terms of, you know, using curcumin or some sort of supplement that you might have heard about as helping in chronic fatiguing illnesses, no, they just don't work. We've tried that. Certainly would love to see it. The tip-off to helping MSH may actually be in another regulatory neuropeptide, and that's called VIP, or vasoactive intestinal polypeptide. And that one, as opposed to MSH that we can't buy legally, we can get VIP, and people that are using that as we are in controlled clinical trials are actually seeing fairly spectacular reduction of chronic fatiguing illnesses once we correct inflammation and then restore control of inflammation. The sad thing is that VIP will not work if you don't control the inflammatory response to start with. Mm-hmm. But what we do is we restore command and control.
Are you familiar with BH4 in the liver?
I do not know DH4.
B as in boy, BH4.
Do not even know B as in boy, H4.
Okay. I was just curious. A friend of mine is doing research on brain functions and stuff, and we were talking the other day about depression, and she said to me, you know, there are more, there's more serotonin in the liver than there is the brain. But if you don't have this BH4 enzyme in your liver, and it's a genetic thing, she said, no matter how much serotonin you have there, it's not going to work. You have to keep that liver healthy, and you have to keep it to be able to get rid of the toxins. So I was just curious if you had heard anything about that.
I don't, and that's the fascinating and humbling aspect of what I do, is that I only know of the inflammation chemicals, and this is a giant field, and
yeah.
I would love to hear more about what your friend is coming up with in research.
Well, I'll share it with you maybe when we hang. Her name's Amy Yatsko, by the way, and Mark Navu. Okay, next question that I have for you. I wonder, since there is a lot of serotonin in your gut, if this leaky gut syndrome, if this mold, if that could be one of the reasons why people have such depression with it.
Well, remember, MSH is critically involved in regulation of the limbic system. I didn't use that jargon term, but certainly when we look at psychiatric aspects of these inflammatory illnesses, they're incredibly common, and it's not unusual for people to be diagnosed incorrectly, as it turns out, with depression or stress or anxiety or panic disorder or somatoform disorder. By the time I get to see them, I've usually been through a drawer full of antidepressants that didn't have a chance to work and never will work. Now, depression is real. There's no question in my mind that people respond very nicely to antidepressants when they are depressed, as a general rule. Of course, in medicine, everything has got outliers. But if you have an inflammatory basis for the psychiatric illness, you're just not going to get better by taking antidepressant. It is really important to recognize that management of inflammation is fundamental to eliminating the putative depression that people have. Now, having said that, serotonin is incredibly important as a neurotransmitter, but depression is way more than just serotonin. So we know that serotonin, like some other of the amine precursor and uptake deamination pathway compounds in the gut, is important in gut motility, in gut regulation. There are others as well. I mentioned VIP, vasoactive intestinal polypeptide. That's where its name came from, but bradykinin and a whole series of kallikrein, for example, have gut effects as well. Now, serotonin got a lot of attention as a gut mediator through carcinoid syndrome and its evaluations and all that. But the real issue is that if you have carcinoid syndrome and normal MSH, the so-called leaky gut is manifested by some of the malabsorption in the terminal ileum, just doesn't take place. It's really kind of incredible. But is there an association of individuals with mold illness who get carcinoid with leaky gut? Yes, it sure is. They get low MSH. And in fact, people who have supplemented MSH when you could get it from Australia, their leaky gut has cleared up pretty quickly. There have been supplements available for MSH, just not available now. Back in the 70s, MSH was given to pregnant women and children, for God's sake. But that stopped in 1991 with the new FDA protocols.
Interesting. You also talked about something that I found very interesting. You know, we had really bad flooding here in Georgia a couple of months ago. I don't know if you saw it, but
yep.
It was over everybody's roof. And I had some flooding, I did, in my basement. And so I learned something in your book. Shortly after we had the flooding, everybody started shocking one another. And one young man that lives in my house upstairs, a friend of ours, shocked a light bulb so strongly that not the switch to turn the light bulb on, but the light bulb itself, and it came on for only an instant, but it still came on. So I thought that was very interesting in your book, talking about the ADH and the salt content and the static shocks. Because I'm sure there's other people that have that problem too. Could you talk about that, please?
I'd love to. Thank you for asking. It's one of my favorite topics because,
amazing.
You know, in all of my med school, and I thought pretty good continuing education, nobody ever talked about increased susceptibility to static electrical shocks as being a common symptom. But lo and behold, over 60% of mold patients have that. And I couldn't figure out why that happened. You know, people would tell me they use their elbow to turn on a light switch. And I go, why would you do that? And they said, because it hurts a lot less to get zapped in your elbow than your fingers. But, you know, car doors and people and, of course, you know, shocking kitty cats is always great fun for those that don't have cats. But I love cats. But anyway, it's one of the things that it was wild. And so just as an off chance, I started measuring sweat chlorides in people's skin just to see if their sweat was real salty, because if there were extra salt in the sweat, that would create an electromotive force, and basically people will be discharging the electromotive force to a ground when they touch a light switch or a doorknob. And lo and behold, the sweat chlorides were higher than any syndrome I've ever seen in my life. And I didn't know then, but I do know now, that it turns out that MSH deficiency prevents normal release of antidiuretic hormone. That's the hormone that holds on to free water. And so without ADH, people will start peeing all the time, so they get this frequent urination. They start getting thirsty. But what's actually happening is their blood salt level, or osmolality is a measure of that, rises. The sweat glands kick in. They take the extra salt out of blood, stick it on the skin. You get shocks. And so with MSH deficiency, you get thirst, frequent urination, and these static shocks. Now, as you get further south, the Florida people rarely have it. The California folks don't have it. Hawaii people rarely will have these static shocks. But it's not a matter of being in the wintertime in low humidity air in New Hampshire that's a result. It is a basic physiologic manifestation of MSH deficiency.
That's amazing. My daughter also said she had two watches stop working at the same time, too.
You know, there's a guy comes in, and his chief complaint is that he was frustrated because he bought Palm Pilots, and then he would put them in his hand, and they stopped. And there are people that will say they put their hand close to a computer, and the computer turns on. People walk past a radio, and the radio fuzzes out. I mean, there's a lot to do with electricity that I don't understand.
I'd like to talk about, if we had more time, about that and something that Robert Johns at Princeton talked to me about, consciousness. I know we don't have time to do that tonight. So I learned some other things, too, that I want you to go over, and I want to save some time for you to talk about what you want to talk about, so remember that. I want you to talk about blood sugars and amylase. I'd like for you to talk about gangrene, abnormal blood clotting. And I'm really interested in cholesterol, bile, and heart disease. And I wondered, would less of them do any good to help with the problems that go on there? Just curious.
Well, let's take in reverse order, because they're a lot of fun. One of the critical issues to me is that we have been sold a bill of goods, in my opinion, by big pharmacy and pharmaceutical companies about cholesterol. I mean, the ads for pharmaceuticals to lower cholesterol are just horrendous. We're now being told to lower cholesterol in children. We're told to lower triglycerides. And when the triglyceride drug salesman shows up, I had great fun with him. I said, can you show me one paper ever that showed benefit in reduction of cardiovascular disease from lowering triglycerides? And then they kind of mumble and say, well, no. I said, thank you, you can go now.
It kills. I mean, you start on those things, and then 10 years you're dead. And you're miserable, you know, two or three years.
Well, if they don't kill you, you're a lot poorer, and you've had this fantasy land that you're actually doing things. Remember, the studies that were quoted in 1986 with the National Cholesterol Education Project, the NIH convened group of 21 experts, looked at five studies on white men between the age of 40 and 65. And that included the Evans County, Georgia study, by the way. And it showed if your cholesterol is over 240, that you had an increased risk of having a heart attack. And there's no question. Every study worldwide, whether they're Scandinavian populations or not, all showed it. But there was no data on women. There's no data on Latinos. There's no data on blacks. There's no data on children. There's no data on people over age 65. But that's not what the committee said from the NIH. They said you must lower your cholesterol under 200 using a diet that had never been tested, never been proven. And if the diet didn't work for everyone, we had no data for anyone other than white men, then you needed drugs. And the drugs we had available, cholestyramine is an old-fashioned one. Have we talked about that? There was Lopid or gemfibrozole and niacin that had horrible side effects for the last two that didn't work anyway. And the drug panel said, well, the good news is that statin drugs are around the corner and they'll be here any day now. That was November 1986, and in January 1987, guess what was released? Mevacor. It's just spectacular what's happened. So cholesterol is obviously one of my pet peeves. You know, I think we're all sheep when it comes to believing what we're told by an advertiser as opposed to looking actually at peer-reviewed published data. But needless to say, you mentioned diet, and as far as amylose and amylase, you know, it was funny, before Bob Adkins died, and I think his death was not an accident, but three skull fractures from a slip and fall in the snowbank doesn't make anyone have conspiracy theories, I guess, besides me. But nonetheless, Bob Adkins was telling me that, you know, he had figured out that fat helped people. And I talked to him about leptin. So when you raise leptin by eating fat, like he said,
okay,
you turn on the production pathway to make MSH.
Tell my listeners what leptin is.
Leptin is a hormone released by fat cells. I'm sorry. Thanks for the reminder. Released by fat cells to take fatty acids out of blood and put the fatty acids into fat cells where they can be stored. And so when you eat foods that are fatty, leptin levels rise, and then leptin, taking fatty acids out of blood, will then cross into the brain and tell part of the hypothalamus that I've had enough to eat, and it'll turn off the eating areas of the brain, and MSH is directly tied to those, but it turns on production of MSH, so it's a wonderful feedback mechanism. You eat fatty foods, you turn off appetite. If you have inflammation illness, you have cytokines knocking out the leptin receptor, this activator leptin has got to use, and you don't get the MSH rise. So people don't stop eating, and the data I have is about a third of people with refractory weight problems is due to inflammatory responses and low MSH. So weight issues are tied to MSH, but MSH is also tied to melatonin and normal restorative circadian rhythms of sleep. So that MSH deficiency, you get non-restorative, non-restful sleep. When you make MSH, you also make beta endorphins at the same time MSH is made. So without MSH being made, guess what? You don't make beta endorphins, and we all know about the endorphins of the runners when they get their runners high. So look at this illness. It makes you tired, it makes you have pain, and it makes you fat. What a nice illness. And it's really, really common. I'm sorry, you asked me four questions. I only answered two.
I'm sorry, it's just horrible what this does and people let it happen.
But it's not horrible now that we know it. You know, I'm going to tell you again that knowledge is power. We know these mechanisms. We know the physiology. It is not hocus-pocus. It's peer-reviewed. It's published in countless thousand papers. I mean, you go on PubMed and you log in for chronic inflammatory response syndrome, you get 1,000 hits. TGF-beta-1, 50,000 hits. MSH, 10,000 hits. VEGF, 20,000 hits. I mean, these are not compounds foreign to current science, and all I do is apply them to a select group of people with refractory pain, refractory fatigue, refractory lost life.
Okay, so let's move back to the liver and the gallbladder and the bile for a minute.
Okay.
I know that from reading your books, the liver is the place that helps get rid of these if it's healthy. Is that right?
It sure is, and we know the liver can metabolize compounds with various enzyme systems, and we talk about detoxification pathways. The real issue for these biotoxins is they're small, they're reticular kind of shape, and they aren't metabolized. And the liver cannot stick a sulfonamide group or a sulfonyl group or any kind of group onto these things. So what's the liver do instead? It has little tiny cells that line gallbladder ducts, bile ducts called canaliculi, and these little tiny cells have got enzyme systems that dump these anion compounds, these negative charge compounds, these toxins, into bile, where the bile then flows down the intestine, and from the intestine you should poop these things out. But no, these compounds are reabsorbed. So this entero or intestinal hepatic, meaning liver, the circulation between intestine, liver, and bloodstream keeps right on going. Cholestyramine interrupts all that, and it binds compounds like cholesterol. That's how it lowers cholesterol. It binds bile salts, and it binds these biotoxins. So if you have a biotoxin in your body that you breathe in from a moldy building and circulates through, eventually goes from cell to cell, ends up in the liver, dumped into the bile, it normally is reabsorbed unless you have cholestyramine present, and the illness will be perpetuated unless you treat it. And if you're then treated and the bile is now cleansed of these compounds and everything's fine until you get re-exposed again, the sad thing is there's no defenses against re-exposure. And in fact, with re-exposure, the inflammatory responses are now activated or turned on. So that the next time you get exposed, you get sicker quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So bile then is not fast enough a method to excrete these compounds. So that the key is not just to be taking cholestyramine if you're a biotoxin patient as your first step, and there are 10 more, by the way, and cholestyramine is just the first. You need to stay away from water-damaged buildings.
Okay, let me ask a question here then. I don't know why this is, I keep being interested in it, but I am. If you take lecithin, you know, that being an emulsifier for your bile, does it help get rid of it, or does it make it worse?
Well, lecithin, remember, is also called phosphatidylcholine. It's one of the compounds that is made by our bodies and stuck into our cell membranes. We need it to live, we need it to survive, we need it to reproduce and everything else. The problem is when you take lecithin, you're asking the question, can supplements overcome normally controlled metabolic processes? Well, usually the answer is going to be no. I don't have any data at all, and we've looked at lecithin in some detail, trying to see, does this supplement make a difference or not? Remember, lecithin has been thought to be helpful for heart disease and kidney stones and diabetes, and probably more that I don't know about, but those are just three in the last 30 years. And unfortunately, a lot of people like lecithin, but at the same time, there's no data that says that that's what's going to happen.
For some reason, it just keeps coming into my head. Okay. Let's see how much time we have. We got 20 minutes. I would like, and I'm going to let you talk however long you want to, but I wanted people to know that mold problems can cause dysfunctional uterine bleeding. It can cause an androgen problem with androgens and hormones. It can cause problem with gangrene. So talk about that however long you want to, and then talk about what you want to talk about until about 5 till.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
when we need to look at endometriosis and dysfunctional uterine bleeding, I used to say that if I had MSH in my hand, I could clear out over three-quarters of the GYN wards where the lady is suffering from these horrible problems if only I could give them MSH. We know that if you look at data from the Endometriosis Association, inflammatory cytokines, and especially TNF, are a huge player in how endometriosis develops. Why we don't use Enbrel and Remicade for endometriosis is beyond me, but at the same time, somebody is going to do that sooner or later. But the real issue is that is an inflammatory process that's out of control. If we look at dysfunctional uterine bleeding, what we're really saying is there an abnormality of gonadotropin control of particular androgen and estrogen and progesterone type hormones? And the answer is yes. 40% of people with MSH deficiency will have abnormalities of androgens, and of those, nearly 100% will have what we call upregulation or increased production of an enzyme called aromatase. Aromatase converts testosterone over into estradiol and down into estrogen that goes. Why is that important? Many people, men especially, will have problems with MSH deficiency and testosterone falls and DHEA falls, androstenedione falls, because they're not getting the right amount of gonadotropin stimulation. And someone says, well, here's some testosterone. This will help you feel better. Well, when you take the testosterone or put it on your skin or get a shot or something crazy like that, what happens is that if you've got aromatase, you're basically feeding the enzyme to convert testosterone over into estrogen compounds. And so testosterone falls, and the basic problem for a guy with testosterone problems with too much estrogen now is made worse. In a woman who has aromatase upregulation, and she's got androgen too, by the way, if that is going on with her, she'll get this extra surge of estrogen as opposed to progesterone. So she gets this increased thickening of uterine lining at mid-cycle, and she starts spilling over with bleeding mid-cycle. It doesn't stop. Someone comes along and gives them some progesterone. It helps temporarily. But this vicious cycle of MSH deficiency, lack of control of androgen physiology, increased aromatase activity, leads to perpetual bleeding problem that ladies see, not just 5 days a month, but every single day, it seems, for a large number of unfortunate sufferers. Along the same way, with androgen physiology, what goes on is that MSH is also controlling production of an extremely important compound called transforming growth factor beta 1, TGF beta 1. And this is a jargon term for me, so I apologize if I say it too fast, but we don't have much time. And TGF beta 1 is huge in autoimmunity. Now, you mentioned gangrene a couple times. What actually happens with TGF beta 1 as the levels rise is that it'll knock out normal control of lymphocytes called T-regulatory lymphocytes that are controlling detection of what we call self. And our body separates what's an antigen from the outside world compared to what's an antigen from the inside world, so-called non-self versus self, by saying, don't attack my own kidney, but attack somebody else's kidney if you put it in me. And we need this distinction to survive, but TGF-beta-1 knocks out that, it blurs the distinctions, and you get autoantibodies like crazy, especially gliadin antibodies in children, so they can't tolerate gluten. And then, and especially in women of childbearing age, they get increased levels of cardiolipins. These cardiolipin antibodies shut off blood flow, especially in the gravid or pregnant uterus. So first trimester fetal loss is incredibly common in these unfortunate people. But in folks who aren't pregnant who have those things, what we see in the higher levels of cardiolipins is shutting off blood flow into digits and fingers and toes and gangrenous changes. Cardiolipin antibodies can affect kidney and brain. It is just a disaster once this immune mechanism has gone awry. But TGF-beta-1 doesn't affect just gliadin antibodies with dietary tolerance of gluten and cardiolipins. It also affects the compounds involved in chronic ulcerative colitis, the ANCA antibodies. We see that in Wegener's granulomatosis. We see this in juvenile idiopathic arthritis, that we used to call juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. We see it in polymyositis and dermatomyositis. You know, it is just one of these inflammatory conditions after another. It's fascinating to also look at people who have false positive ANA tests, and that's the anti-nuclear antibody we think about with lupus and all that. A lot of times people will have positive tests out of the blue, and the doctor says, well, no, I did the extra test, and you don't have lupus, but you've got a false positive. If you measure the TGF-beta-1s, the levels are off the charts. TGF-beta-1 also will affect scarring in the liver. It's a huge player in illnesses that look like cirrhosis, that are not cirrhosis, but still cause liver inflammation. But the most important issue is that TGF-beta-1 changes cells that line bronchial tubes in the lung. They remodel these cells. And instead of being soft, feathery, columnar cells that help filter particulates out of air that we breathe as we breathe, they turn into thick, tough, fibrous tissue called fibroblasts. And this idiopathic fibrosis is clearly due to TGF-beta-1. But more importantly than that, most of what is being called asthma and this huge explosion of asthma across our country is elevated TGF-beta-1. Now, how much of that is from mold? I don't know. I know that the EPA has published wonderful studies looking at the increased incidence of asthma in researchers from Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, 2 years ago said that 21% of all asthma in the U.S. was due to mold. Well, if that's the case, if we go back to this concept of remodeling, and that's the buzzword for asthma, remodeling. What are we really saying? We're transforming one cell into another. So TGF-beta-1 is giant in this field. And we can now correct TGF-beta-1, correct the inflammatory compounds that give us so much problems. Now, there's others. Complement itself is a group of 32 proteins that are preformed, ready to go as part of the innate immune response. We need them to fight off bacteria. We need to fight off foreign invaders with them. Complement's involved in so many different issues. But activation products of complement can be upregulated or turned on because the enzymes that make these things are one of the few in the body that are what we call auto-activating. They turn themselves on. So C4A is a marker of an immune process that's on autopilot, so that when someone leaves a water-damaged building and they say, well, good, I'll be safe now, I'm out of the mold castle. No, they're not at all. The real issue is that if the C4A production mechanism is turned on, it stays turned on until somebody turns it off with medication. But not everyone gets these things. Here's the genetics. And, you know, if we talk about, you know, genetics all the time and susceptibility, the immune response genes found on chromosome 6 called HLA-DR, everybody's got two copies, one from mom, one from dad, and we know that certain of these HLA types are associated with terrible problems, not just from mold, but other biotoxins. And in fact, 24% of the population has the genes that says that if they're exposed to water-damaged building, sooner or later they're going to get sick. So that means that if you go into a school that's flat roof with water-damaged and stained ceiling tiles in the kindergarten pod and musty smell and moldy books in the library, only one quarter of the kids and the staff will get sick. And so if majority rules, well, those kids are just making it up because the rest of them aren't sick.
Interesting. I want to say you have a test on your website, right, that people can purchase. There was something, I saw a test on your website that they could purchase this package and do this.
There are two websites that I work with. One is called chronicneurotoxins.com. And the other is biotoxin.info, and there really is a .info. Each one of these websites makes available the visual contrast test, which will give you an idea of whether or not you have the inflammatory responses to biotoxins. And you can find out, I think it costs $15 or $12, something like that. It's not free, but it's not horribly expensive, and actually it's pretty darn good as far as a test. And combined with symptom recording and statistical measures, basically on biotoxin.info, you can get a statistical representation, you know, very, very quickly of what is the probability that there is a biotoxin illness present or not. If you have a positive test like that, then you should be following up with the labs that are listed on both websites. I mentioned HLA and MSH and TGF-beta1, C4A. These tests are all available. Insurance companies will pay for them if you have insurance, and they're ones that are reproducibly reliable so that you don't have to guess. You can actually put your illness on a piece of paper and get started with treatment.
Does insurance pay for treatment now?
Sure.
Okay.
We work with Blue Cross Blue Shield and Medicare, but you know the folks that we see are coming in with illnesses that are represented by codes in the ICD-9 diagnostic book, and there's nothing hocus-pocus about it. Yes, indeed, insurances cover them all the time.
Good deal. Okay, I'd like for you to tell one more time where people can find you, and is there anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't covered?
Well, I want to thank you for sharing an hour of your time with me. You've asked wonderful questions. I do a lot of interviews, and your questions are about the best organized that I've seen, so many thanks for that. My office is in Pocomoke, Maryland. Phone number for the office is 410-957-1550. There are two websites, chronicneurotoxins.com and biotoxin.info. But the real issue is that I think you start typing in on Shoemaker and mold illness on Google, you'll find some good things, good and bad. I guess as people get to know you, then some people throw rocks and other people don't. But our group has about 20 peer-reviewed published papers. We have a lot of research going on. The new research we're doing on genomics is truly exciting, because now we're going to look at 40,000 genes and look at an exact fingerprint of which genes are activated in people who are sick and not in, in those that aren't sick, and vice versa, so that theoretically we should have the opportunity to go into a building, do one blood test, and basically give reasonable medical certainty on whether there's an inflammatory problem or not.
There was something else I was going to ask you about. Look at my notes here. Oh, the thing about the wingspan, the long-arm wingspan, we got just a couple of minutes. I thought that was very interesting.
You know, the nice thing is that in deposition, some lawyers used to make fun of me, saying that I was diagnosing illness by knobs on the head, by saying that it's interesting that people with wingspan greater than height had so much autoimmunity, and their genes were always ones that we saw that were susceptible to mold. Well, it turns out there is a mechanism for that, and that's my old friend TGF-beta-1. And the mechanism for long arms you see in Marfan syndrome and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is...
Will you describe what that means? I'm sorry, but I don't know that.
Okay, you remember Abraham Lincoln, right? He was real tall and long-armed and all that, and he had aneurysms in his aorta, and Marfan syndrome is one you hear about with... Just look on a basketball court or in a women's volleyball court. You'll see them. Then look at the ice dancers, by the way. These long-armed, slender people with long, long, long fingers. They don't have the collagen cross-linking, so their joints are so flexible. They're so mobile. And yet, because they don't cross-link their collagen, they actually are at risk for some problems. But they all have high TGF-beta-1. If they're exposed to mold, they get nailed. There was a fascinating picture of Michael Phelps in Sports Illustrated after he won his 8 gold medals, and you could see him taking his fingers all the way down his back below his scapula and just say, well, look at this flexibility. You see this in the young girls who are short and not tall with their gymnastic ability, and they can put their clasped hands straight in front of them on the ground and then step one foot through and then the other foot through and then bring their clasped hands back up their, past their rear end up over towards their neck. That kind of hypermobility is lack of collagen cross-linking. The gristle is not very stiff, and it's associated with this TGF-beta-1, which of course we now know is associated with these autoantibodies. So wingspan greater than height truly has a physiologic mechanism, and it's probably the best example of body habitus, genes, and environmental acquisition of illness that we have.
Very, very interesting. I don't know that anybody would ever think about that, you know, to look at it. Okay.
Well, you start looking at people and, you know, this guy's strange and this guy's strange. Well, hell, they all have got the same thing.
All right, Dr. Shoemaker's book is Mold Warriors. And for you people who live in the Northeast or may want to go to the Northeast, we didn't even get to talk about this. He wrote a beautiful book, Discovery Nature Trail. Where can they look at that, Dr. Shoemaker?
Yeah, it's the Pocomoke Nature Trail Discovery. I forgot what he called it.
But it's a beautiful book about the area where you live.
Yeah. When you have respect for nature, hopefully you have respect for humanity as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on my show, and thank you for what you do.
And I thank you, and maybe we'll have a chance to talk again when the genomic stuff comes out. I know you're going to want to hear about
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I want you to call me and let me know.
You got it.
Take
All right.
Care.
Good night now.
Good night.
Bye.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health.
Just
tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr.